Welcome to Podcast Ed, the podcast of RedefinedOnline.org, covering the stories behind the new definition of public education. On this episode, Step Up for Students President Doug Tuthill talks with Dr. Ashley Berner, Deputy Director of the Johns Hopkins Institute for Education Policy. The two discuss how a more vibrant, content-based curriculum system is critical to the future of public education. They also discuss the balance of faith-based schools having content-rich curriculums and staying true to their basic beliefs. Dr. Berner says it's incumbent on leaders of faith-based schools to have the courage to have a thorough review of curriculum, ensuring their schools are giving excellent materials to students, and that there's strong religious reasons for that as well. They also discuss rethinking assessment models with a content-rich system, and more. Thank you for listening, and enjoy the episode.
So today we're here to welcome Dr. Ashley Berner. We're very excited to have Dr. Berner, who is an distinguished professor at Johns Hopkins University. That's my title. I'm not sure what your formal title is. So why don't you give us your formal title at Johns Hopkins?
Well, first of all, thank you so much for having me. I admire your work at Step Up for Students, and it's a real pleasure to be talking to you today. I would love the title of esteemed professor or distinguished professor. I'm actually an associate professor at Johns Hopkins School of Education and the deputy director of the Johns Hopkins Institute for Education Policy.
Great. Well, you've written a couple of four columns now for Redefined. So we thought we'd have a conversation and do a little deeper dive on some of the topics that you've been writing about, which we're very grateful, by the way. It's gotten great response from our readership. So you talk a lot about content-rich curriculum. Why don't you quickly give our listeners a definition of what you mean by that?
So a content-rich curriculum is one that seeks to systematically build students' knowledge in subjects, specific knowledge, not just skills, and that has knowledge building as one of its primary goals.
Can you give an example of what that looks like?
Sure. So right now, I just finished being on a ministerial panel in Alberta, Canada, and reviewed their curriculum. Their curriculum is knowledge rich. They require every year that students in their province know certain knowledge base, certain facts about history, about English literature, about math. And the students across all different kinds of schools need to demonstrate that they understand this content. So in this country, we have some curricula that do a really good job of building knowledge in the core domains. Core knowledge, language arts is one. Wit and wisdom is another. There are several that are very strong.
So what's the relationship between a content-rich curriculum and skill development?
All right, so as my colleague David Steiner is fond of saying, try to think critically about nothing in particular. You have to have something to think critically about. And so just to back up for a moment, knowledge-based curricula are the perfect platform to learn skill development. When we talk about skills, first of all, it's a little bit subject specific. In math, the skills of doing fractions and the high level concept knowledge of, say, division are very much the same. You demonstrate knowledge of the concept by showing the skill of doing it. But when you look at more of the humanities, more of the ELA and English language arts and social studies and even science, the skills that they're talking about are very different from the content. So in ELA, for example, we talk about the skill of finding the main idea. Well, finding the main idea can be done on the back of a cereal box, or it can be done with Dr. Zhivago or the Scarlet Pimpernel or some of the fun texts that kids read in some really good schools.
Talk a little about the tension between teachers having the freedom to create their own, you know, their own curriculum. You know, I want to teach dinosaurs, or you know, and how does that tension play out? I mean, how would you see that tension playing out?
Well, that's a very good question. So a couple of years ago, the RAND Corporation did a national survey on how teachers used materials and for what purpose and why. And the stunning high-level finding, or one of them, was that teachers were drawing on a daily basis sometimes from a very eclectic group of online materials. The number one, two, and three resources that they used were Google, Pinterest, and Teachers Pay Teachers. And our institute does a similar survey that we fielded in dozens of districts across the country, and we see the same thing. Teachers are selecting materials, even if there's a curriculum that they're meant to be using. They supplement, or they craft their own art, their own content. Now, there are several problems with this. First of all, even if a given teacher is really great at selecting materials, when you think about the life, the educational experience of any individual child from kindergarten through 12th grade, you have to ask, even one teacher who's really good at selecting materials, how does that, does the child have a coherent experience of the K to 12, of the, every subject in K to 12? And the answer is no. So what feeds into this problem are three things. First, historically, most democracies just democratized the liberal arts. When they expanded public education, they just required that, first of all kids couldn't graduate without knowing certain things in all the major subjects. And in our country, originally, our founders supported the liberal arts curriculum is really fundamental to democratic formation. But in the early 20th century, there was a big battle, intellectual battle, over what should we be teaching. And progressive education, as we were, I'm just simplifying here, but progressive education essentially said, no, every kid doesn't need to know these subjects. They just need to know how to learn. They need the skills. They need to have vocational training. So for more than 100 years, we have not required a content-rich curriculum. In our schools, we don't require it in our teacher preparation programs, again, unlike many of our peers. And so we're kind of hit from all angles. We have a lot of adults who have not experienced this kind of education, and we don't give teachers the support they need to deliver it.
So let me try an analogy for medicine. There's a lot of science, obviously, that dictates what kind of treatment a doctor would give given a certain diagnosis. And that's pretty standard. Now, there's some wiggle room, but generally, you know, it's a pretty predictable response based on the science and the history of what works and what doesn't work for various diagnoses. Is that something similar to what you're suggesting here? I mean, you wouldn't let a doctor come in and say, you know what, today I just think I'll do this, or today I think I'll do this. I mean, they're kind of restricted somewhat by what the science says is best practice for a particular diagnosis. Are you arguing something similar, that in education there is a science, there is best practice? We know that from a cognitive psychological perspective that previous knowledge is critical for comprehension, and that we should have some parameters around the curriculum that's consistent with what we know about how people learn, how cognition works, what the science tells us about human cognition.
That's a really good way to put it. In many ways, it is very similar to medicine, in that we've known empirically for a long time that a content-rich curriculum closes the achievement gaps between wealthy and poor kids, and that school systems that institute a knowledge-rich curriculum and test on that material, not skills-based assessments, that has an outsized positive effect on student learning. And Diane Ravitch made this case a long time ago, E.D. Hirsch has made this case, and now the science is really demonstrating why that is so. So the foremost scholar here is Dan Willingham at UVA. Natalie Wexler's book on knowledge really goes into this in beautiful detail. But the point here, I think you mentioned, is the stickiness of knowledge. The more that you know, the more you can know. Knowledge builds on knowledge. And the reason why this is so important in the way we structure our K-12 experience is that you want children to have access to the same basic subjects in increasing depth year on year. So I did my doctorate at Oxford University, and my children were with me in England. All the schools followed the national curriculum, even though they were in a private school that was funded by the government. Every single first grader has in-depth learning about the Greeks and Romans. My kids knew more about the Greeks and Romans than I did when I graduated from high school. They knew the terminology, how roads were built, the forms of government, the terms, all of this. And then in the curriculum, they're meant to revisit it at later grades. And then, of course, by the time you get to your final exam years, you're actually critiquing what you've learned.
So one of the big challenges we have in this country is obviously equity. I mean, there's huge inequalities. And a lot of those inequalities stem from the fact that kids have different experiences out of school. You know, I have some friends who have young children. They've already taken them to Europe. You know, they've taken them to museums all the time. They've been to Williamsburg. You know, they go all of these places to see all these historical situations and monuments and learn a lot of history by actually going places. Would a content-rich curriculum help deal with some of those inequalities? Would it sort of help level the playing field to make sure that there's a more common understanding that you don't necessarily have to have parents who take you to certain places to have the kind of content knowledge you need to understand how our democracy works?
Absolutely. This is you really hit the nail on the head. This is an equity concern. And this is something that our institute says to school system leaders of every kind of school, whether it's charter, private, or district, that there will be children in every school system who have well-resourced parents who can take them, as you said, to Europe, to museums, who talk about current events around the dinner table. But if you're from a family where you've got a single mom who's working three jobs, or you've got first-generation parents who just came to this country or who didn't go through college themselves, those children need access to this content too, even if they don't have the financial or the social means to get it. And so schools can play that critical bridge for them. And in fact, that's what we see in the research, the very, very powerful Catholic school effect that James Coleman and Tony Breich found with Catholic high schools. Yeah. Catholic high schools, at least during that time period of study, closed the achievement gaps between wealthy and poor kids in 4 years. In fact, sociologist James Coleman wrote about this in the 80s in very strong terms, that they were actually fulfilling the mission of the common school. They were fulfilling the common good. Well, what was it about the Catholic schools? Strong school culture and a robust liberal arts curriculum. The OECD research shows the same thing. The highest performing school systems have knowledge-rich curricula that level the playing field.
So I'm glad you mentioned faith-based education, because a lot of the stereotype out there is that if you attend a faith-based school, that the content is going to be weaker, has to be somehow weaker because it's a religious school. Is there any reason why a faith-based school couldn't have, well, you just mentioned Catholic education, is there any reason why a faith-based school also couldn't have a very content-rich curriculum while also being true to their basic beliefs?
Well, absolutely they can, and there are many that do. So there are a lot of classical Christian schools that actually require Latin and have a lot of, they take the knowledge build very seriously. There are Jewish day schools and Islamic schools that are incredibly rich intellectually. And then, of course, you have variability in every school sector. And the challenge would be to say to school leaders of faith-based schools, have the courage to do a thorough review such that you're giving excellent materials to your students. I think there are strong religious reasons for that as well.
Let's talk a little bit about instruction of a rich curriculum in the current world we're in. Obviously, all the kids in the country at some level are doing distance learning. Most people appreciate that we open up in the fall with social distancing requirements and the way schools are constructed. There's going to be a lot of distance learning in the fall, regardless of what it looks like. How does that impact how teachers teach a content-rich curriculum? I mean, what's that look like in a blended learning model? Talk a little bit about that as we move forward.
Yeah, it's a really good question. So I think the same hope pertains that kids are getting a content-rich curriculum, and that whether they're getting that in a bricks and mortar and face-to-face, or they're getting it through online or remote learning via public television, for some example, which is how, let me come back to that in a second, but that the content is rich and that it's consistent, coherent year to year, that there's a purpose to it and that there's a direction to it. The reason I mentioned public television is because where I live in Baltimore, Baltimore City has adopted Wit and Wisdom and Eureka Math. Very few kids in Baltimore, or a hefty percentage of kids in Baltimore, don't have access to the wireless and the internet. And so Great Minds has partnered with public television and is delivering daily lessons in that format. We have to get really creative about doing that. So, I also think that the coronavirus has given us the opportunity to think about how we could structure the teaching force so that teachers with really strong subject matter expertise could be delivering the core content, and that teachers who are more focused on building connections with students can create kind of smaller group learning models for them. There are some nimble ways to handle it.
Wow. Talk a little bit about assessment. How does a content-rich curriculum impact how we think about assessment? Obviously, as we rethink things, rethinking assessments also, I think it's been on the table for a while. I think moving forward, we're going to be grappling with what new assessment models look like. We've been talking about authentic assessment for years and years and years. And I think when you talk about content rich, you're talking about understanding. You're not just talking about regurgitation of, you know, the War of 1812 was in 1812. You're talking about what are the social and economic and political conditions that might have impacted the War of 1812, and why did it happen the way it did. So what is it? Talk a little bit about how you envision, you know, if Ashley was head of the world, you know, what would assessment look like?
Wouldn't I love that? Assessment would look like states giving a menu of options for district, charter, and private schools to take at the end of a year that were tied to specific curriculum. So, for example, there's a state assessment in ELA for Core Knowledge Language Arts, one that can go with Wit and Wisdom. And all of those tests would have to be validated, of course. There'd have to be, you know, studies to make sure that they were measuring the same thing and that they were comparable and so forth. But that actually say to kids, you read this body of texts, or you studied the Civil War. And then don't just answer true or false, fill in the blank, matching. Tell us something about those. You know, answer meaningful questions, higher level integration of new content into the content that you've already learned. Actually, Doug, the exciting thing is Louisiana is doing this already. They're doing this with their most commonly used ELA curriculum, namely guidebooks. They've actually, and our institute's been working with them, so has NWEA, and it's a really exciting assessment model. They've also been able to reduce testing time because they're bringing in social studies content, and I think it's a virtuous circle. So teachers no longer have to disrupt their classroom to teach skills that are disaggregated. They can just continue to kind of nurture the skill building through these rich texts and then teach their students how to think about the knowledge in a creative way. It's very exciting.
Good. I talk a lot about to my staff, this is the futurist in me, dreams about a day when we have virtual reality as a much more powerful learning tool. I'll just give you an example. I've always been fascinated by the conflicts or debate that George Washington had during the Revolutionary War with Congress for funding. You know, he was always complaining about, I need more money. It was ongoing back and forth. It'd be fun for me to sit in through virtual reality a scenario where actually I was in the room while they were having that debate. So talking about having a content-rich curriculum, I've always wondered, how close are we to allowing kids to actually experience a content-rich curriculum in a way that's much more motivating and powerful, not just on a 2D piece of screen or piece of paper, but I can sit in the room and watch George Washington argue for more money from Congress. I can sit through a debate about large states, small states, you know, in a constitutional convention. I can sit down with a marine biologist in California and talk about global warming and how it's affecting the seas and coral reefs. That's the kind of thing that would just turn kids on. So I'm curious about where's the industry in terms of the curriculum providers getting to that point.
Oh, I don't know about the curriculum providers. I think I don't know the answer to that. But I do know that this is coming. And I think the big question is it scalable at cost? Because there are some wonderful tools out there that would allow kids to sit in on debates or to visit a museum,
right,
or to go look at the Andes. You know, if they're studying the Middle East, to actually be able to experience what it looks like to be, you know, why Iran is a strategically important country, you know, and to spark the imagination and to make it come alive. And I think there are some school systems that are usually working in third world countries, actually, that have been able to access tools like this at the classroom level. I think the real challenge is going to be getting it to the student level. So this remote learning context, we just don't have the money to let every child have his or her own device right now. But I agree, that would be fascinating. It would make the content come alive, and it would be incredibly equity building.
Well, you've been really generous with your time. Is there, you know, you and I could talk for hours. Is there any other really critical piece of information I haven't asked you about that you'd like to share?
Let's keep this conversation going, you know, and carry it to new audiences and give teachers the tools that they need and the support they need to really deliver exciting content.
Well, Ashley, I'm a big fan of yours. You're playing a really critical role nationally, certainly in Florida. You're having a huge impact. You know, we're partnering with you at Step Up for Students, trying to work with our schools and think about how to really upgrade the quality of their curriculum and their instruction. I just want to thank you for everything you're doing. I mean, it's really important work, and I'm really grateful.
Well, thank you. I'm grateful for what you all are doing. You're on the kind of forefront of extending access to excellence to so many families. So thank you.